pretty pleased with yourself, really.
I understand that I am one of the luckiest people on the planet. I am literally doing what I would be doing for free anyway.
Yeah.
And welcome back to Not an Audiophile. This is episode 38, season 2. And today we have an interview, a very interesting interview with a very interesting loudspeaker designer with a slightly different outlook on how things could or should be, and that is Mr. John DeVore. Are you craving incredible sound? For over 47 years, Len Wallace Audio has been guiding hi-fi enthusiasts on their audio journey. They're not some corporate machine, just a tight-knit crew of audiophiles and entertainment lovers obsessed with great sound. From precision turntables to immersive home theatre systems, they handpick gear that delivers. Stop by their store in Lane Cove, Sydney, Australia, or visit lenwallaceaudio.com. Len Wallace Audio, where your passion finds its sound. Before I can go on with today's show, I've received an announcement from above, from management, the people that run this show, not me, to read out a very important announcement from management in a serious voice. Here goes. Dear Andrew, please read the following out on the next show. Request all listeners, whether they're enjoying the show or otherwise, to follow the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or their podcast platform of choice, their app of choice. And also, it reads, request that they subscribe on the YouTube channel for Not an Audiophile podcast. Thank you. And on with the show.
Hey, we're very lucky at Not an Audiophile today to have the gentleman of wide baffle hi-fi loudspeakers, John DeVore. I'll do another intro.
I like that one. That's funny. You know, it's true. The 096 is old, and when they were introduced, it was a weird concept that I got a lot of resistance.
I don't want to go on and on about wide loudspeaker front baffles, but it is an obvious feature immediately, and made more so by the beautiful timber veneers, which you have made, I mean, part of your signature, I suppose.
Yep.
How did that kind of get started? Was it something you theoretically, or, you know, from the science aspect of it? I mean,
yeah. Well, it definitely came form followed function with the wide speakers. Yep. So all the original DeVore Fidelity speakers were pretty typical narrow columns. With
yes, you actually started with what was fashionable at the time, and yeah. I guess still is.
The whole Gibbon series. Yeah. So the first 10 years or more, first more than 10 years.
Oh, so that's interesting.
Was all the Gibbons? Yeah, Gibbons and Silverbacks. They were all the typical narrow stacked woofer style. And the 096 project, really, it was a side project. Because in the U.S., I shared, especially early on, I shared a lot of my dealer network with Shindo Electronics.
Yes, yep.
And Ken Shindo has zero, he passed away, but he had absolutely no interest in modern speakers. All of his amplifiers were fully optimized for high impedance. It wasn't so much sensitivity, it was really impedance. It was like 16 ohm, even 24
really?
Ohm even.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, classic Western.
So he had
design
reasons with his output transformers or something.
Well, it was just what he listened to.
Yeah. Okay.
He designed everything to be presented to that load. And so the dealers, they could do vintage Altecs, they could do Shindo's own speakers. Mm-hmm. But it was a big limitation. Mm-hmm. You know, the doing a horn speaker is not going to be right for everyone's room.
No.
So the idea was to make a speaker that was DeVore Fidelity flavored, but that was a much higher impedance and much higher sensitivity, just really specifically to fill that gap in the dealer lineup. And so that project was the 096. And within 6 months, it was our top-selling model, and it has been every year since then. It's really remarkable.
It feels like I feel like I wasn't aware of the brand before the 096 in a way.
Is that how it was for business as well?
Did it ramp the business up another, like, in the sense that it didn't affect so much the existing line as far as sales, that it was an adjunct to that, it was an extra bit of business.
It was an additional one, yeah.
Because you were accessing kind of a different demographic of listener or audio enthusiast, I guess.
Originally it didn't seem like there was a lot of cross-pollination. Mm-hmm. Originally it was sort of like I had dealers that were quite focused on the Gibbons and dealers who were quite focused on the orangutans.
The dealers would be a bit like that, yes. Yeah.
And
the,
I got a lot of pushback. So dealers, once the 96s started to get out there and I realized that they were going to be much more universally applicable than I had originally planned, I would be like, I would tell some of my big dealers who were resisting, look, you know, they're just like, oh, absolutely no. We have no customers for that vintage sound. Nobody's going to want these. It's not our kind of thing. And I'm like, look, get some demos on the floor. If they don't work out for you, I'll take them back. You can use that credit for any other model. Yes. It's fine. You know, there's no risk. And so without fail, every single one, they would get them on the floor. Suddenly, every customer who walks in the door looks around and sees an 096 and like, what is that? I want to hear that. I'm going to bring my wife in. She's going to love these, right? Yeah. So it was pretty quick.
So that's actually, and that's part of, is that, yeah, I I thought that was on mute, that phone, and it is.
That was mine. Mine.
Oh, was that yours?
Mine is now on mute.
Sounds like an Uber bloody, it doesn't matter. So wife acceptance. People go on about it. I mean, it is important if the system is in the main lounge of the home or something, rather than off in a separate detached.
Which
music
is my
room.
Target. I want them. Yeah, to be
yeah. You want
I
to
want
be
everyone
part of
to
their
hear
life. Yeah. And so there has been good acceptance for that sort of wider look.
Huge.
Do you think it's partly the very attractive timbers, and of course you can kind of choose how obvious that figure of that timber is to some degree. You have different veneers and what have you.
A big part of it is, I think it's two things. One, the design aesthetic comes more from, I mean, so superficially the 096 looks like a cartoon speaker, right? It's a hard-edged rectangle with two circles on it and some little legs, right? You tell a six-year-old, draw a speaker, that's what they're going to draw.
Yes.
But on the other side, like more subtly, it's the design aesthetic is furniture. It's not hi-fi. Mm. You know, so you compare it to something that's very high-tech looking with all kinds of metal and color, you know, just all the stuff going on. Yeah. It's just a very busy visual presentation. I think there's a refreshing simplicity to that style that attracts somebody who's not a high-end audio lover, but will appreciate something great sounding in the living room. And I think that was sort of a compromise. And for sure, the veneers on the front have an impact, and the fact that I designed it originally to be very easily customizable, so we can put other veneers on that front face for specific tastes.
Yes, with the manufacturer's eye, I was just looking at the demonstration pair, which are 096, are they?
Yeah, that's a standard.
A standard version. Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. That you've got here at the show. We are recording this at the Melbourne 2025 Australian Hi-Fi Show. It sounds lovely in the room. They're changing something with the system. I'm keen to go back and hear it again. Not changing it
to make it easier for our interface. It should sound the same.
So, I'm going to go back and listen to some familiar tracks of my own later on. But so far, so good what I heard, even though I wasn't familiar with the music. But which brings me to my point, which is that kind of that design, it does fit in mediocre room acoustics perhaps more effectively or easier than other loudspeakers. Is that true, do you think? And then is that a function of the wider baffle? Because the wider baffle is obviously clearly how you get a little bit more sensitivity.
Yep.
And of course you've designed it to be a very even higher impedance. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a design choice in the driver specification, what have you, in the way you design the crossover. But is there another reason why you like the wide baffle? Is it something to do with like diffraction or something, or what?
Absolutely, So, so the wide baffle was not initially a specific design choice. It was dictated by the high sensitivity nature. So, high sensitivity. Also, I had found in all my experiments that let's just use the classic single-ended 300B amplifier. Mm-hmm. Night, you know, big, very high output impedance amplifier. No feedback, so it's quite sensitive to the load it's driving. Yeah, the load it's driving really does have an influence on the way that amp is going to sound.
Yes.
I found that by a huge margin, a two-way or even a one-way speaker is a much better sounding option on a, on an amplifier like that than anything more complex than that.
Because you end up with a more even impedance curve, do you think?
Or? I think it's, you know, having the number of crossover points in there, I think, is a big part of it. I'm not sure. I mean, I love the sound of two ways objectively stand alone anyway, right? But I think because the ear is, the ear always can hear crossover regions regardless of how perfectly they're implemented. So as you reduce those, you know, you get a bit of an advantage. But I think it's just keeping a whole crossover point out is just better for the amplifier.
And better for the amplifier.
It's really that's what I was aiming
for. So you're getting a more enjoyable sound, partly because of the speaker, but the way the speaker reacts with the amplifier is helping the amplifier.
Assuming
as well.
The amplifier is happy in a high impedance, the amplifier absolutely sounds better.
So
it's a little bit of a cheat. It's a cheat for me as a speaker designer. So that was dictated by that, and the high sensitivity demands a much larger woofer. So that is what pushed the baffle size much wider. And then, as I sort of experimented with that, and more on after it had been finished and out in the world, and I heard it in a lot of different areas, so the sensitivity thing is absolutely right. So it increases sensitivity by basically pushing down the step response of where that happens, right? So you push down the step response, and you literally get more mid-range energy out into the room.
March Audio, fantastic amplifiers. Alan March has been on the show a couple of times. He's a great guy, very, very smart cookie, and he manufactures a range of amplifiers and loudspeakers using Purify components in most cases, which we all know are extremely high quality. So check out March Audio, great sound, brilliant build quality and design, and in fact, I believe there is a new preamp, which is a ground-up design of their own, coming out from literally a clean sheet of paper, marchaudio.com.
So anechoic sensitivity doesn't change, but definitely room sensitivity to the listener increases.
Yeah, I suppose anechoically it measures, it'll still measure differently.
It'll measure different and you'll see a step response, but really in the room, that
if you have
half
close
space,
to the, yeah, if you
yeah,
have
well
them,
that half space launch yeah. gives you that energy yes. forward versus yeah. where it starts to become omni, you lose that
around the back of the box, I suppose, effectively.
So that's a part of the sensitivity thing. But in terms of room interaction, because I've pushed that step response, because I've pushed that wrap frequency lower, there is less mid-range stuff spraying out into sidewalls and everything like that.
It
directs more of the energy forward.
So I think in that sense, you can
go closer to a sidewall with an 096 than you can with like a Gibbon Super 9, where it's going to be much more omnidirectional at a higher frequency.
I feel like I have a list of things in my phone somewhere, infamous phone that made that noise earlier, that things that some manufacturers are doing that everyone was doing in the 70s, because we went away from wider boxes.
Absolutely.
We went away from bigger boxes. We went away from bigger drive units. Mm-hmm. We went down into small, skinny little boxes. And then there's this slow...
It's the curse of the 80s. And that was purely fashion. So in the 80s...
it kind of was, wasn't it?
It was. So when I was... I started in the industry. I've been making speakers for myself since the mid-80s when I was in school, but I started working in a hi-fi shop in 88 in New York City. And one of the brands that we sold that I did quite well with was Boston Acoustics.
Lovely.
And they were a great affordable level, but really great designs.
Yes, they were.
And they were primarily at that point sealed large woofer designs.
Fairly wide.
Yeah, and they were quite wide.
With like 10-inch drivers.
Yeah, some 8-inch drivers, very wide baffles, and they were beautiful sounding. Mm. And they were very consistent room to room, quite easy to drive.
Yes.
And then 89, maybe it was 90, something like that, they changed. And you could see the world was, you know, with Teal and Wilson, and the world was squeezing this narrower look. And BMW went from the 801 to the 802, which was clearly a much, much bigger seller than the 801 was. So it was just, this was the trend. And Boston Acoustics, they changed from that old brand was the A series, A120, A150. Yes. They went to a T series, which was a tower, narrow.
Yes.
They went from a single 8-inch to a pair of 6.5s.
Yeah.
So they followed that trend. And there was a sales training, and the guy from Boston Acoustics was there, and I was already very deep into the speaker design.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was a salesman, and in my experience, the T-Series speakers were absolutely not as good as the A-Series speakers. Mm-hmm. And so I asked him as politely as I could for in being in New York.
So not particularly politely.
And he agreed 100%.
Yeah, is that
like,
right?
He liked the A-Series as well, but he said that the market demanded the T-Series, you know, because there was this whole idea that a speaker cannot image if it's not narrow.
Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
And it's just, these are all false. They're not. None of them are true. Right. A 96 can image. Right. It images. It's fine. It doesn't image any worse.
I was just listening to
it. It generates the sound in a room in a different way. But
yep.
They're certainly capable of imaging. But it was a style thing that has absolutely, it's now taken over. And then since the 96 came out, so that's 2012, I'm not going to remember the date. But since the 96 came out, before the 96, there were definitely some brands, you know, Harbeth is a classic example, you know, using big woofers, nice big wide
big
presentation,
box,
big box. Audio Note, but there weren't many.
Monies,
Audio Note basically just carrying on the tradition of the Snells that they're based on, right?
Snell is something that you were aware of back then that you listened to?
We also sold Snell. I sold a ton of E's, the old Snell E's, J's, all of those, the original Peter Snell designs.
I suppose before that, in that period of the 80s, there were it was even in the 80s that the narrower box was coming in.
Well, that's when it was happening.
Yeah. But then by the 90s...
By the 90s, it
was a
taken
no-no.
Over.
Yeah, there's no way you were having a 12-inch three-way in the 1990s.
Right. I mean, after Peter Snell passed away and Kevin Vex became the designer there, that was what was happening. So Kevin did... He sort of updated those classic ones a little bit. So Snell E3s are a Kevin Vex design, but they are very much that Peter Snell design.
Yeah.
But everything after that, Snell C's and D's and everything, those were all became the narrow thing that you know Kevin went on to do with Revel and all of his success since then. And that was in the 90s. So that's when it happened.
So so you were somewhat ultimately, though, even though you were resistant at the start, mentioning to the sales rep of Boston that, you know, you weren't too sure about the improvement that there might be coming from the narrow baffle, obviously became somewhat indoctrinated, because when you started your manufacturing company, you did, of course, follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
And is that because it felt insane to build a wide baffle box at that point?
Yeah.
Because really no one was doing it.
No.
And yours is, of course, the widest, so... when you did decide to do it, you thought you'd do it properly. But is that because you made different width baffles and you just found that that was what worked?
Two things, yeah. I started the company in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, my experience with wide baffles was just vintage. All of the ones that I was selling, I was working sort of part-time selling hi-fi all through the 90s. And there were no speakers left like that.
No.
So maybe it was subliminally in the back of my mind. I certainly had some favorite vintage speakers that were still that looked like that. But for me, the impetus to start the company in 2000 was to make 100% regular looking speakers that behaved 100% regular in people's listening rooms and sounded like a good, modern, regular speaker, but that were very sympathetic to low power.
Yes.
And that had, at this point, it was just, my target was really even 8 ohm impedance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the trend along with those narrower baffles was lower sensitivity and much lower impedance.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved a lot of vintage integrated amps, like little Scott, Sherwood, Fisher, those little tube integrated amps.
Yeah.
And those need 8 ohms or higher.
Yes.
They absolutely
need. And a bit of sensitivity, I guess, as well.
Yeah, and some sensitivity. Powerful. It's a little push-pull EL 84. Yeah, so low power in the teens or something. So that was my design brief, was to make normal speakers. And in that case, that was a narrow tower.
Yes.
But that had that high impedance and easy drivability. So it was sort of, it was in the DNA early on. Mm. But it wasn't so audacious as to make a big, wide two-way.
Well, I guess you're introducing a new brand to the market. You probably don't want to be too sort of audacious or too. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's. I feel like in my own experiences with this that you want to actually just make a product that is accepted, that is of a, you know, an acceptable quality, and people can't go, oh, it's a piece of crap. You know, I mean, you really want to make something that's. I guess what people are used to buying. Was that partly your thought process? Only with the caveats of what you just mentioned, that you wanted the extra sensitivity and easy to drive.
The things that were different about my designs were intentionally hidden. They were inside.
You didn't talk about it too much.
To be normal looking. I wanted them sitting in a store, someone going around listening. I wanted them to be chosen for the sound. I wanted them to be chosen for a nice small size.
Yes.
These will work in my room.
Yep.
And I wanted them to, you know, somebody had a little carry amplifier or even a, you know, an entry level VTL audio research, something with tubes. I thought these speakers, again, going back to having a sympathetic load on your speaker, making the amplifier sound better. Mm. I thought that would also give me an advantage in a hi-fi showroom situation. So that was my thinking at that point. And I'd never considered revisiting that sort of wide baffle thing until it sort of came organically with that design of the 096 and the wider.
With the experiments that you conducted with bigger drive units.
And immediately I was just like, oh yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like I remember my lesson from 15 years ago.
It's kind of, I mean, it's just fashion. It's awful in a way.
It's a fashion.
Awful's an exaggeration, but I mean, it's such a shame that fashion gets in the way of good audio or acoustic design, really. But I guess it doesn't necessarily.
I think you know. You go all the way back in the history of hi-fi, and you have wide baffle speakers that were great, beautifully engineered, awesome sounding, and you had them that were terrible sounding.
Oh yeah,
they were just thrown together in marketing or whatever.
The bangers,
it was.
As we call them here. Yeah.
Listen to that. You know, the demo in a room is in a hi-fi store is listen to how great our tweeter is, right? You know, it's like so that existed with the wide, with the narrow, with planar. You know, that's you know, it's like. Oh well, great music only, you know, ended in the end of the 70s, right? That's bullshit. We all know that great music existed all the way back to cavemen banging rocks against rocks, and some of them had the rhythm and some of them didn't, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same as today. So, So the fact that I started DeVore Fidelity with narrow models. That obviously I liked and I approved of to put them out for sale means that I didn't think that it was impossible to make a good sounding narrow speaker, and there are plenty out examples.
No, it's clearly not impossible. Yeah. No, but there's some lovely advantages to a semi infinite baffle sort of arrangement, which is kind of what it is.
Yeah, and it's come into fashion quite a bit since that original 96 came out.
Is there? I must admit, off the top of my head, I can't. I mean, there's all the ones that you mentioned Harpeth before. I mean, they're clearly still seeming to be powering on and doing largely the same thing they've probably always done.
Yeah.
And they steadfastly do not do a narrow floor stander.
Right.
But other UK brands have done, they do a bit of both. And I was involved with a brand for years that did do both. And I mean, I much preferred the classic ones. So, you know. To a couple of other things not related to acoustic design, although we'll take a 2-second break and we'll be right back with John DeVore.
Hey Now Hi-Fi wowed music lovers at the recent StereoNet Hi-Fi and AV show. The Fisher & Fisher loudspeakers, the dome and turntable, the beautiful-sounding airtight tube amplifiers from Japan. Now, all of this gear, along with Jeff's other rooms that he had fantastic equipment in, is all back at the store, ready for you to listen in-store or talk to Jeff about an in-home demo. Jeff, Hey Now Hi-Fi, ring him today. Or email, SMS, maybe smoke signals, pigeons.
And we're back with John DeVore. By happenstance, he's visited Australia for the 2025 Melbourne Hi-Fi Show, very generously donating some of his time to us at Not An Audiophile. We've just had a great chat about how the various models happened and got underway, particularly the Wide Baffle 096 and its derivatives. There is a pattern with your model naming. I can't find any reference to your love or otherwise of apes. Is there something there we should be talking about that you'd like to mention?
There are. There's two stories.
There's
two stories. The first one story, and they're both equally accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been making speakers for almost 20 years before I started the company.
Yeah.
And it was a mix of me just experimenting for my own curiosity and, you know, tearing up a bottle to reuse stuff for the next experiment, or selling them to friends to fund the next experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did a commission pair of speakers for a good friend of mine in the 90s, and it was a beautiful little two-way stand mount, and I built it around a driver that I had always loved and I had absolutely admired in some of my very, very favorite mini monitors, mm-hmm. and it was the Seos 11FGX, a legendary paper 4-inch, 11 centimeters.
Yep.
And so it was a little two-way based on that, and I had, as I mostly did, but I had incorporated everything I had learned up to that point, and I had a bunch of ideas that were really sort of new that I was really curious to try out.
Mm-hmm.
And that speaker really, it came together beautifully. I was really happy with that speaker. And I spray painted them just a simple black, and they were kind of cute, kind of funky looking, and I named them Gibbons.
Okay.
Just to be fun. Like they were playful sounding and whimsical.
Yes.
And so it was that pair of speakers that really got me thinking more seriously that I could have a company, because the things that I was doing in that speaker really did open up some sonic stuff that I wasn't hearing in the speakers that I was selling in the stores.
Yeah.
And so that fed that idea. And so naturally, I named the first two models Gibbons because they were really descendants of that original Gibbon speaker.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Gibbon 3, Gibbon 8 were the first two.
Because models. That's where you first thought, maybe I can
do this. It was really, I evolved what I did in that speaker into these speakers for production.
Okay. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
The other reason is it is pretty blatantly poking fun at the seriousness of the industry, right? I mean, we're here to hang out and listen to music and be absorbed in music.
Yeah, indeed.
And these people who are just like, these are the XKR reference ultimate signature blasting via ultra super max. I mean, I'm like, come on guys, like let's appeal to people's, I don't know. For me, it got absurd. And so it was a direct thumb on the nose to that sort of naming tradition.
I think it is quite enjoyable. I mean, they're likable animals, right? I mean,
absolutely. They're fascinating, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the orangutan, I guess, is a...
Well, the orangutan came about because...
It was a wider,
right? The orangutan's big, wide face.
I
looked at it and I was like, well, there's an orangutan for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I had the silverback. So they're all, it is all apes. You know, I keep it all up in our little ape family here.
Yeah, and you've got, I'll edit that cough out. And the second one. Yeah, and silverbacks as well. Yes, yeah, yep. Yeah. Yeah, so if you were ever to... we won't go down that path. I'm just imagining other models that may involve different... the favourite or the least favourite... we don't have monkeys in Australia, right? But our near neighbours... if you visit Thailand or something, you've got the macaques, which are a troublesome ape.
Not apes.
Well, because they're monkeys. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a defining thing, is it? It's so got to be apes, yeah. Not monkeys. Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. Should we talk about how many other apes there are? But I mean, at this stage, I mean, you clearly bring new models out very carefully in over a decade or so. Yeah. But that does bring us to another thing that I'm interested to ask you about. So these loudspeakers are all manufactured in Brooklyn.
Yep.
Is that New York State or is that next door?
New York City. It's part of New York City.
Yeah. Yep. Excuse my lack of understanding of the East Coast of America. Because we live in Australia, we only really know the West Coast because it's very convenient to get to.
Right.
I can tell you all about the Southwest, but not much about the East Coast, very embarrassingly. You'd think for someone my age, I would have been there more than once. That's where you grew up. That's where you were selling hi-fi. Is this right, or are you?
I didn't grow up there, but I moved there right after university.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always lived there.
So you've lived there a long time. Mm-hmm. It was a natural progression to want to make products there. I mean, because it's more convenient initially, I guess. And you had been with your home designs, clearly making them there.
Yeah.
The first production ones were
sawed in my living room. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they really were. And it was just me. I mean, I didn't have employees or anything. So, so it did. It just started out very organically and gradually.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we essentially expanded space as we needed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so now, I mean, I have no idea how many people you have. I imagine you have a dozen people working for you. I have no idea. Less. Mm-hmm. Most quite famous boutique-y sort of loudspeaker companies have a surprisingly small facility.
Yep.
And a surprisingly normal, only necessary amount of workers, and that's exactly what you've got, obviously.
Yep.
You've got some very talented people working for you, obviously, who do a very nice job of piecing these things together. Has that been hard to get that team together? Or has it happened organically as well?
It has sort of happened organically. So the company remains very small. And we started, our growth from the beginning was extremely slow. It was mostly me, you know. I was just sort of, because it was only me, I didn't have a sales rep, so it was just me wearing all of the hats. So for a long period of time, it was me, not for a long period of time, but for a long period of time, it was me and one other employee.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then it might have been two, but it was for most of the history, the first half of Dwarf Fidelity, it was me and probably one person.
Okay.
And then it was, so there's two sort of two halves. There's a cabinet half as well.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
Our cabinets, they're all made in the same facility. It's all one lease, one space. But the cabinet shop is run by this guy, Anthony Abate, who has Box Furniture Company, and they make beautiful equipment racks.
Yes, yes, yes.
And 100% of my cabinets. So he has had himself for a lot of it, or himself plus one.
Yeah. Okay.
So for a very long time, there was really just four people
making
every Dwarf Fidelity thing.
Yeah.
And that grew to maybe not even double the size. And we sort of hit a ceiling, because where our factory is, it's in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is a Navy Yard. We made battleships for World Wars I and II. And it was decommissioned in the 1970s sort of handed over to the city of New York as an industrial park.
Yeah, okay.
And so our space is in there, and it's wonderful. It's it's vaguely subsidized by the city, so our rent is not as high as it would be if we were just outside.
Yeah.
So it has allowed us to really sort of grow and develop in there. And we utilize a lot of the other companies around us if we have extra excess need for more CNC. There's a couple of shops around.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a great infrastructure.
Industry happening in this ex-naval
inside
yard.
The Navy.
Yeah,
yeah,
okay. It's a great place to be located, of course.
It's wonderful, yeah. And I walk from my house to, it's perfect.
You walk, that is fantastic. Yeah.
But we hit at some point we hit a ceiling as to how many we could make in our footprint.
Of course, yeah.
And it was very difficult to get more space in the Navy Yard. And it wasn't until about 2 years ago, so we, our growth plateaued for a number of years. About 2 years ago, a big company moved out on the floor that we're in.
Okay.
And we were able to essentially double our footprint all of a sudden. And so now we are back to being able to continue that growth.
So you can, yeah.
So part of the reason is, part of the reason we are the size we are now is because we sort of stopped growing for a time.
Yes.
We did grow, but it was very slow and it was tough. It was like, we were just trying to figure out how to be more efficient within our really cramped space. Exactly.
Yeah, well, that would have been a pleasure when I can imagine the almost glee at someone else's expense, I guess, unless they were moving to bigger premises or what have you. But the fact that someone was moving out and you thought, this is it.
And there, of course, is the scramble for all of the tenants.
Everyone
who wants
a
space.
Yes, yeah.
But we had been there longest and we had been asking longest. Okay, so we got it, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So it has been organic growth over many years, or 25 years. You're not really celebrating the 25 years there's not signs up everywhere. It's quite an anniversary, right?
Well, we did 10 and we did 20. Yeah, so our 20th anniversary, we made a special speaker.
Yes,
so
it
was essentially, it's what became the O'Brons. It was called the 20, and we made 20 pairs.
Yeah.
Each one had a beautiful little bronze, individually numbered badge on the front.
Yep.
And they were 100% custom. So anyone who bought one of those 20 pairs chose all the veneers, whatever they wanted, and they were really beautiful. So that was our 20th anniversary. The Gibbon 10 was technically, that was our 10th anniversary speaker.
Yep.
It came out a little late because I designed very slowly, but that was technically our 10th anniversary speaker.
Okay.
So we've been noting those little.
It's quite an achievement. I mean, 25 years in the loudspeaker business. It's an achievement to actually sell them and make money, but then to do it for 25 years, you must be pretty pleased with yourself, really.
I understand that I am one of the luckiest people on the planet. I am literally doing what I would be doing for free anyway.
Yeah.
100%. I love what I do, and it's remarkable. I am not a good businessman. But I have managed to sort of manage it through.
I disagree with that statement. I mean, you've done what many people try to do, and you've pulled it off. But I mean, I guess the first 10 years was slow and probably tough, required a bit of grit. You say you design slowly. Is that because you sort of let, I don't know, ideas just creep up on you? Or are you, what's
no, the... My design process, it's slow intentionally. Let's use an example. So there's a speaker model that maybe needs an update. So let's say I went from the old Gibbon Super 8 to the newer Gibbon 88, right? So it's really just sort of the same idea, but a refresh. So in that situation, the concept already existed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a two-way, small, compact, floor-standing two-way speaker. My process is a circular process. So there's prototyping. So we design all of our drivers as well. So there was the first thing is Seos makes for the most part. Seos makes all of the drivers. So there's this sort of collaboration with the engineers at Seos, and since I've been working with them since the beginning, they have a really clear idea of what I'm looking for, what
achieve.
I need. So we get in some various prototype drivers. Maybe in some situations I'll get a couple of off-the-shelf ones to at least get our cabinets started or whatever it is, but usually we wait until we get the first round of prototypes. And then it becomes this sort of circle of listening, measuring, listening, tweaking, experimenting, in the real world with crossover adjustments, tuning adjustments, cabinet adjustments, at some point driver adjustments. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of real world happening in my office in the listening room. And then more measuring, and in addition to the sort of measuring, you get you sort of model the speaker in the computer, and you can do sort of simulation and stuff that. So then that feeds back into the next session.
So
in the real world.
So you're taking measurements of your functioning prototype
all the way through the process,
then and doing computer further modeling with that, and that helps lead you to the next version of the prototype.
We get a handful of the prototype woofers. Each one of those gets modeled, put in the computer. So then we can figure out, you know, our first round of cabinets, tuning, things like that. It's a starting point. And so that so that is a circle, and then you know, we get a certain amount of knowledge from that measuring and simulation process, and then we get an additional amount of knowledge from those first builds and all of those experiments, and then, you know, and so that goes around and around and around many, many, many times, and all throughout that process, sometimes we realize that we need to abandon one of the prototype drivers. That's not the one. You know, we stop chasing that idea. We need to fold some of these ideas into a next round of prototype drivers. You know, so that, you know, because they're in Norway, you know, that's a slow process. Yeah, so each generation of prototype drivers adds months to any gestation.
Yeah, so therefore period. That's part of your making it a lengthy process is the simple fact that you might request some modifications, and it's 3 or 4 months before you receive them.
And then that process, that in that time frame, I'm still working. So I'm still developing ideas, sort of refining other elements. Maybe the tweeter's getting refined while they're working on the woofer that's off my plate. Maybe I'm dialing in some changes to the overall size, listening axis, whatever it is. So that's all still happening. And then once things settle, so let's say production drivers have gotten to the point in the prototypes where I'm not going to need any more. So I know that's going to be my production driver. Then the focus shifts a bit. And as somebody who's designed speakers, you know, at some point, you get to the point where the big elements aren't going to change so much at all. You know that you've got the overall sort of geometric footprint. You know what the listening axis you're aiming for. You know the general performance envelope. And then it's refinement. And that happens over a long period of time, over a huge amount of different music. Different places. I hump the speakers to different friends with very, very different rooms.
Yes. Yep.
My personal, I bring them home. Mm. I bring them to friends with big lofts. I bring them to people with, you know, rooms with big, comfy, overstuffed furniture.
Yes.
You know, so they make that circuit quite a bit. I bring them to some of the stores that I have great relationships with as well. Yep. I get to hear them on other gear. And then I also have people over. So one of the things that I've found is that I'll sort of go down a little design rabbit hole. Maybe I'm chasing something really particular. And I'll get lost. I'll be at a point where I've got three versions and they sound different, but I don't know which one's right.
And you can't,
And so, the simplest solution for me is I call Anthony over from the cabinet shop. Mm-hmm. He comes and sits down, and I'm sitting way off axis, and I play him the three versions. And before he can point out the obvious and say, version two, obviously, I've been sitting over here, my mind has sort of been cleared, and I'm now listening vicariously through him, and I'm like, oh, sorry, two. Yeah, and he's like, yeah, right? So sometimes, you know, sometimes it's just that. You need to sort of do a reset because you've chased, and I...
Yeah, you become
you get really this narrow
stuck,
focus.
Stuck, yes.
Yeah, and
yes,
you are stuck.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I see this in other designs out there, not even necessarily speakers, but you see these people who have very clearly gone down a rabbit hole and released a product without maybe stepping back
for a month
and looking at the big picture, right?
Yeah,
you know, and so that's one of my safety checks for sure.
Yeah, that's one. I think it's. In fact, I mean, I've noticed. It's human nature, I guess. You do. I guess you may agree or disagree on this, but you do tend to. What's your favourite speaker? Well, it's the one I'm working on at the moment.
Yeah.
And then you. And that's part of that human nature of just being excited about something that you've, yet another thing that you've made work, mm-hmm. I think, or got it to a point where it's kind of enjoyable to listen to, and mm-hmm. Or whether whatever else it is you're designing, car, bike, what, boat, what have you. Mm-hmm. I think I know. I can't think of who those people are.
You're living and breathing.
You're stuck in it.
You're living and breathing
it. In a little bit of a circle.
Yeah.
And you need to just go, well, I'll just sit that over there and think about that for a while and come back to that. I'll go and build some production speakers or something.
Yeah, friends with good ears.
Yes.
Or, you know.
You release them into the wild for a bit and then, bring them back and go, oh, yeah, I'm still, yeah, I get that. Yeah, I think it's working. Yeah. Or something like that.
Yeah. Or I think I was right, you know, two steps ago and I need to retune, you know, I just need to retune the bass port.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Yeah. It could be something small like that.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you for all of those insights. It's an absolute pleasure, John. There's many things we could talk about. But you're at a busy hi-fi show. I hope it's busy.
Yeah, it seemed like it was filling up.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. absolutely. I mean, it's the first hour or so of the first day. It takes a little while to heat up.
Yeah.
It is cold outside, though, so the people will come inside to
bring
them in for the hi-fi show.
Yeah.
So thank you again. Thank you so much. I would love to speak to you sometime in the future when we don't have the music in the background.
Yep.
And ask you a whole set of other interesting questions, if that's all right.
I would look forward to it.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you.
The Hi-Fi Shop is the home of quality hi-fi. Experience the best of everything from affordable turntables to not-so-affordable high-end loudspeakers. Let Alex curate a complete system for you or have him using his technical background assist with your next upgrade. Visit in person or check the website hifishop.com.au for easy information on all of your favourite brands. Go straight to the top, speak to Alex at Hi-Fi Shop.